I'm upset. Welcome to Quarantinima, aka Quarantinima, aka Quarantine Enema, the only podcast where we don't know how to say the name of the show. My name is Connor Sullivan. Thank you very much for joining us today. Happy last day of February, everyone. We did it. We finally got through the shortest month of the year, which is why I chose to do a dry February instead of a dry January, like most people do. It's three less days of torture. So that ends tomorrow, so that's going to be fun for me. Anywho. But yeah, so, all right, busy episode today. We'll get right into it. We're going to talk about a bunch of movies today. I got to watch a lot of stuff in the last week or so. So, little tease, we're going to be talking about, let's see, The French Dispatch, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Lost Daughter, Mitchell's vs. Machines, Eyes of Tammy Faye. I watched a bunch of stuff this week, a lot of movies. And we'll even touch on the SAG Awards, which it is 9:40 on Sunday night as I'm recording this, so they're still going on. There's been a couple big wins. It's been more so TV stuff. They're wrapping that up now. But Troy Kotsur won Best Supporting Actor. That was awesome. And then Ariana DeBose won as well for West Side Story. So not too surprising, but the way I record the show, like, the TV is behind me right now, so I'll be like kind of peering over my shoulder. It's really the Best Actor one. That's the one that's going to be the most telling as to, you know, where we're going with this one. But anyway, in the meantime, let's get to our featured film of the day, and we are going to talk about Whiplash, one of the great movies of the 21st century so far. So Whiplash, for those of you who haven't seen it, and there, I feel like there's a good amount, but the people who have are very, like, this is the best movie ever kind of thing. It's from Damien Chazelle. It's kind of his breakout film. It stars Miles Teller and J.K. Simmons. J.K. Simmons won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for this role. It's one of just the... It's so goddamn awesome. Basically, Miles Teller is a ambitious drummer at a prestigious music institute in New York City, and J.K. Simmons is his conductor and slash teacher, who is, you know, a little bit kooky. His methods are a little all over the place and a little extreme. So, but it makes for some really, really great you know, entertainment. Some great independent filmmaking here. Like I said, Damien Chazelle is one of his, it was his breakout film role. It wasn't his feature film debut, if I'm not mistaken. But this one was the one that kind of put him on the map, so to speak. Whiplash, it's an adaptation of a short film that he did of the same name. Also includes J.K. Simmons. I'm not sure how he got J.K. Simmons to be in that, but that's neither here nor there. His feature film debut was in 2009. And it was called Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench. So, great. All right, moving on. but anyway, yeah, Damien Chazelle, if you don't know the name, you might recognize him from some of his other work. La La Land, which we covered a few weeks ago here on the show. You can go take a listen to that one now. In 2018, his last feature film to come out was First Man with Ryan Gosling. He's got another movie coming out later this year that's kind of one of those, you know, old Hollywood movies. It's called Babylon. The cast is all over the place. Brad Pitt, Margot Robbie, Olivia Wilde, Tobey Maguire, Samara Weaving, Catherine Watterson, Jean Smart, Spike Jones. I mean, everyone, seemingly everyone is in this movie. Jovan Adepo, I just keep scrolling and I'm leaving out half the people, but yeah, so that comes out and towards the end of this year, so be on the lookout for that one. I'm a big Damien Chazelle guy. Hopefully that'll be more of a return to form from him than what First Man was, but anyway, on to the movie itself. So Whiplash is one of those really great out of nowhere movies, and there, you know, there's a few of these you know, that come out every year. You know, Coda was kind of this one last year, and what I think was so incredible about it, because so when this movie came out, it's came out in 2014. I was in school at the time, and you know, I was in film school, so you know, a lot of my peers, you know, in school at the time are other, you know, film nerds like myself. And every single person was coming out of the woodwork saying, like, you got to see Whiplash. Whiplash is, you know, this incredible thing. And, like, I had read reviews and I'd seen the buzz online, but I didn't see it in theaters. I know that. I think I was a little late to the party. Yeah, I know I watched it, like, in my parents' basement on demand or something like that, but anyway, this movie had just been so hyped up to me, and I was like, all right, like, how good can this movie really be? And it's one of those just awesome times where it's like it comes out of nowhere, and, you know, word of mouth gives you high expectations for it, and then it exceeds those expectations. So everything about this movie was just, this is just great filmmaking, you know, really at its core. I mean, it's it won an Oscar for best editing, deservedly so. The pacing of this movie is, you know, just insane. You know, there's a lot of, you know, it's kind of like jazz in a sense. Like, the you know, I say this about La La Land a few weeks ago, is that the worst part about the movie is that there's so much jazz in it, which I think rings true to Whiplash as well. But I mean, the movie's edited in such a way that, you know, it's a lot of quick cuts. It's very hectic. You know, you get to really see, like, the ins and outs of what it's like being like in an ensemble jazz band, or, you know, something like that. And just the way that, you know, they highlight Miles Teller playing the drums, and, like, the scenes are cut, not necessarily match the music, but, you know, similar to, like, when they're actually playing music, the cutting's a lot more frantic, and it kind of matches the pace of the music. And then when it's not, you know, it's a lot of long takes, and, you know, let the scene play out calmly, you know, when music's not involved, but music is very involved in this thing. So it's kind of like you start to see this, like, psyche of the main character played by Miles Teller, Neiman, I'm blanking on his first name. but, you know, we see him, like, around his family, and, you know, he's dating this girl, and, like, those scenes are very calm. You know, he's very under control. He's kind of this, like, awkward, you know, 19-year-old kid who's got, like, you know, sort of the sense of humor, but he's just obsessed with drumming and, you know, jazz, and, like, working his way up the ladder and becoming, you know, this great musician. He wants to be this, you know, all-time great drummer. And, like, so when you see him in, you know, in his musical setting, it's much, and, you know, there's a great arc to him here. You know, at first he's very quiet, reserved. He's kind of like the backup drummer in the band that he's in, and then he somehow just gets plucked out of obscurity and brought into run with the big one, you know, the big guns, the lead band for the school. And just through a series of blunders from other people, he's able to kind of become the drummer. But then J.K. Simmons' character, who's this relentless teacher, and, you know, he's not afraid to verbally and physically abuse his, you know, his students. You know, he's calling them names, and there's slurs, and he's just screaming the entire time. And, you know, he's not afraid to, you know, throw stuff at his students, and, you know, use psychological warfare and all this stuff. So it's it's a very bad guy. But what the film does is, like, it creates this very interesting debate, because, you know, you see him, and he does get a chance to explain himself later on in the film. You know, he explains how, you know, he has this really great monologue about how the two worst words in the English language are good job, and how people settle for mediocrity, and telling people that stuff is good enough is, preventing people from striving for greatness, and stuff like that. So, like, that's kind of why he is the way he is because he's looking for the next great musician and, you know, looking to push someone there, because if that person is out there, doesn't matter what he's going to do, he's going to push them as far as they can, because if that person's out there, they would never be discouraged and would triumph and get better because of what he went through with them. So, which is a very valid point. And, you know, because the most of the movie is spent vilifying this guy, this teacher, and it's really easy to hate him. But at the same time, like, J.K. Simmons in this movie is fucking incredible. I think out of all the Oscar winners for Best Supporting Actor of the last, like, I don't know, 10 years or so, I'll pull it up here in a second. I think that, you know, J.K. Simmons is probably hands down, like, the best one. Let's see, Best Supporting Actor last 10 years. Okay. I'm just pulling this up real quick. I should have done this beforehand. I'm not great at preparing for this show, as we've all come to know and love. Yeah, so, all right, last 10 to do it. Daniel Kaluuya last year, Brad Pitt in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Mahershala Ali in Green Book, Sam Rockwell in Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, Mahershala Ali in Moonlight, Mark Rylance in Bridge of Spies, J.K. Simmons in Whiplash, Jared Leto, Dallas Buyers Club, Christoph Waltz, Django Unchained. A lot of great performances out there. I think, if any, it's probably like J.K. Simmons and Sam Rockwell, to me, are 1-2 there, in no particular order. And then, you know, then you have the Brad Pitts and the Christoph Waltzes, and then you get, then that's, yeah, Brad Pitt, Christoph Waltz, Mark Rylance, then that's probably when you start to dip into, like, Jared Leto, and I honestly, Mahershala Ali, like, you know, phenomenal actor, but the fact that he has 2 Oscars and he won 2 in 3 years for 2 what I consider below average movies is pretty pretty incredible. But anywho, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about Whiplash. So yeah, J.K. Simmons' role in this one is fascinating. But anyway, going back to his character, like, he's, you know, you're conflicted because, you know, you spend the entire movie hating this guy, seeing what he does. You know, he lures people in, and then he, you know, just screams at them, and, you know, you know that he's doing these horrible mind games to these other, you know, people in the film. I'm sorry, I'm looking over my shoulder right now at SAG, and I think Jessica Chastain just won Best Actress? Huh. All right, I didn't see that coming, but more on that later, because I did watch The Eyes of Tammy Faye. She's very, very good in it. A lot better than I thought it was going to be, but still not great. But yeah, more on that in a bit. So yeah, you know, you're led to think of J.K. Simmons in this one way, and then when you finally actually get to understand his reasoning and his logic behind it, like, you can't help but agree with the guy. you know, there's, you know, and the scene is so well written because, you know, he says, you know, he explains his logic to Miles Teller's character, and he even asks, you know, Miles Teller responds, you know, like, is there a line, you know, what if you push too hard and you end up discouraging that person from becoming the next Charlie Parker? That's the analogy they kept using, some famous musician. And, you know, J.K. Simmons' response to this is, well, like, it wouldn't matter, because if the next Charlie Parker's out there, he wouldn't get discouraged. And you really can't argue with the guy. I mean, he's right. And that's what makes a truly great movie villain, in my opinion, is, you know, if you can understand what they're trying to do, and, like, and if you really believe that they believe what they think is right. Because, like, there's so many villains out there who are just like, I want to see the world burn, like, meh, like, $1 billion, and, you know, we're gonna blow up the moon and shit like that. You know, there's so many poorly written villains out there, but a truly well-written villain is one of the best things. You know, look at the Joker, look at Thanos, look at Hans Landa. When the villain is written in a way that you can, like, you see things from their point of view, and it's not just like a, you know, like, I'm here to get my revenge on the world kind of thing. Like, no, it's like, this character believes this one thing, and it drives all of his actions and behavior, and that's the way he is. And, like, you know, we see it from the protagonist's point of view, and we learn to hate this guy. But then, like, once you actually hear it and you understand it, you're just like, huh, he's not wrong. And then to, you know, cut, you know, fast forward to the end of the movie, after, you know, there's the scene where that conversation leads to the scene where J.K. Simmons, now at this point, he's already been kicked out of the school because of, you know, a series of events with Miles Teller's character, as well as some others. So he's no longer teaching at the school, but he knows in the back of it, and he runs into Miles Teller's character in a bar. So he's able to convince Miles Teller to join his new band that he's doing, and, you know, he's just saying, like, hey, like, you know, we have this drummer who's not cutting it, like, I know you can do it, so do you want to do it? And Miles Teller is able to look past everything that this man has done to him, you know, verbally and physically abuse him, and he joins his band. And sure enough, he gets on the stage in time for the show, and he finds out that you know, J.K. Simmons has completely, like, he lied to him about the music they were playing. He's going up there and he doesn't know the songs that the band is playing. He told them they were going to be these songs. They go up there and they play, you know, a completely different set. So he looks like he looks stupid, and he just, you know, walks off the stage, and but he, you know, gathers himself, he comes back, and then he puts on the greatest fucking drum solo in the history of movies, which, you know, is not even close, really. Maybe Garth in Wayne's World has a close one, but puts on this amazing solo, and then in that moment you see J.K. Simmons, like, wires turn, like, and of course, you know, he's naturally pissed off at him for, you know, he's already kind of gotten his revenge, and then, like, this kid comes back and he's just making it worse, seemingly. But he's able to see what he's able to do, and he was like, okay, like, I think I actually, like, found this kid. So he starts leaning into it, and, like, that, and, you know, they start playing jazz, so to speak. So, you know, based off this kid, you know, what he's doing on the drums, J.K. Simmons is able to build up this entire, you know, ensemble live on stage. And you even see, like, you know, the way he's looking at him and stuff like that. He starts to actually, like, believe in this kid, and, like, he sees how talented he is and what he's doing and stuff like that. And towards the end of the performance, he's actually helping him. At one point, Miles Teller, like, knocks over one of his cymbals, and he's right there to kind of pick it up and set it back up. And then, you know, they're communicating, like, with their eyes at this point, and which is, you know, he's conducting him in a sense. So they go from, you know, I'm getting revenge on you, now I'm getting revenge on you, but in the process of that, they learn, like, okay, like, this kid, like, is showing off how great he can be, which is what he's wanted, you know, his entire life, and he's doing it to stick it to this guy who he hates, but the teacher has realized that, like, okay, like, this is the kid, this is why I've been pushing him as far as he can, because if he's this good, and he wants to be this great, he's not going to be discouraged by anything, which played out. So, you know, it leaves this really interesting debate at the end of the movie, like, was the guy a bad teacher? Because he discouraged who knows how many kids he scared away over the years, but he found this one kid and made him, you know, as great as he was. So it's a really, really interesting debate. And Whiplash itself is just one of the, I mean, everything about this movie is just damn near perfect. You know, the way it's shot, the color palette they use, you know, it's very much shot to, you know, reflect a jazz band, like a lot of golds, a lot of yellows, and dark tones as well. J.K. Simmons' character, his character's so well written, like, some of the insults he's hurling out at this kid are really, really incredible. The movie is made by J.K. Simmons' performance. Really, I mean, I'm sure there's other actors that you probably could have plugged in there and gotten the same, you know, something similar, but the fact that it was J.K. Simmons who, like, and we've talked about him on the show before, and I think we've talked about Whiplash before. I know we haven't This is the first time I've watched the movie in a couple of years, so I know we haven't talked about the movie at length, but I know we've discussed Whiplash and at certain points. J.K. Simmons, he was a character actor at this point. He's a very recognizable face. He's got very distinct features. The eyes, the lines in his face, the ears, the mouth, his voice, everything about him is very distinctive. And, you know, we've seen him in so many other things. Juno and Thank You for Smoking. And I know he was on Oz back in the day, a couple of Coen Brothers movies. I think Lady Killers off the top of my head. And then this one, like, put him on the map. It's just like, okay, this is J.K. Simmons. Like, that, he's not just, like, Juno's dad anymore. It's like, his name is J.K. Simmons, and he's a fucking incredible actor. And then he rattled off. He's kind of kept doing the same thing, which is really cool, I think. You know, he's not only, you know, part of, like when you win an Oscar, like, you get flooded with, like, all these incredible offers and, like, opportunities that you probably wouldn't have gotten normally. But he's kind of kept doing the same thing. Oh, and how could I, J. Jonah Jameson, how could I forget that from Spider-Man? how could I absolutely forget that one? He's up for an Oscar this year for being the Ricardos. I didn't have him in my list of nominees, but, you know, it's not for, yeah, I mean, he's good. Don't get me wrong. I know he was on Brockmire for a little bit, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, BoJack Horseman. So, like, he's done a bunch of stuff in TV, but he's also been in some really great movies, both comedies and dramas. Look at Palm Springs. He was Inspector Gordon, or Commissioner Gordon, in Justice League. And then, like I said, being the Ricardos. I think he's in... Yeah, so he's kind of all over the place, you know, drama, comedy, TV, film, miniseries, like, he's everywhere. The man is just a true Renaissance actor, so shout out J.K. Simmons, one of the best guys out there. All right, moving on, let's get to some Did You Knows. Actually, before, and maybe I'll dive into this one more at a later episode, but the Whiplash and the Oscars for this one, and I don't want to dive too into this just because there's so many other things I want to get to here. So it came out in 2014, and 2014, maybe I just haven't really realized it, but in hindsight, this was one of the best years for movies, like, ever, and hands down the best of the last, like, 10 years or so. Going through the Best Picture nominees this year, Birdman was the winner, American Sniper, Boyhood, Selma, Grand Budapest Hotel, Imitation Game, Theory of Everything, and Whiplash. So that's 8 very, very good movies. Very good to great to amazing movies. I'd say, like, the Theory of Everything or Imitation Game is probably the outlier there, but, they're still pretty good. It's still a pretty good movie. All 8 movies won an Oscar that year. I don't know how many times that's happened where all the nominees, especially in the expanded fields, all the nominees get, win an Oscar, let alone are nominated for more. But yeah, it's one of those weird years where it's like it was nominated and it's like, I think it's the best of this bunch. But Birdman winning, I have no problem with that. Like, it's really bizarre. And then, like, in the same year, you have Grand Budapest Hotel and Boyhood as well. You really could have given them to anyone, and I would have been totally fine with either one. So, just a really interesting year there. But also, movies that came out this year, or that year in 2014, you had Foxcatcher with Steve Carell and Channing Tatum. Gone Girl, which I believe we just discussed on a recent episode here. Was it actually the subject of, like, 2 episodes ago? I'm completely drawing a blank. I will pull that up a few episodes ago we talked about it at some point. Wild, also a really good movie. I know there's more on here that are really, really good. Nightcrawler with Jake Gyllenhaal. A phenomenal movie. Wasn't nominated for nearly enough. Unbroken from Angelina Jolie. That's a really good movie as well. Interstellar from Christopher Nolan. I think there was the Lego movie, I think, came out that year too. yeah, the Lego Movie, Guardians of the Galaxy from the MCU. I mean, there were a lot of classics that came out this year. Captain America, Winter Soldier, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. This was, what a fucking year for movies this was. So, anyway, we'll dive a little more into 2014. It's kind of like 1994, if you ask me, where it's just like, there's so many great movies, and, you know, obviously not everything can win everything, so you just have to... 1994, that was the year where Shawshank Redemption, Pulp Fiction, and Forrest Gump were all nominated for Best Picture, so a little context there. All right, let's get to some Did You Knows on Whiplash, and then we will get to some of the other films that I had previously discussed, which I know I'm running long here, and now I can't find the Did You Know page. There we go. Alright. The director and writer of the film, Damien Chazelle, cannot get funding for the movie, so he instead turned it into a short film and submitted it to the Sundance Film Festival in 2013. The short film ended up winning the Short Film Jury Award, and he got funding soon after. So I still don't know how he was able to get J.K. Simmons and on this one, and, you know, at this point, Damien Chazelle's in his 20s, I think, when he made this, so, like, I remember seeing it and just being extremely, like, almost jealous of it. It's just like, oh my god, like, how did you do this? like, a peer of mine did this. Someone, you know, at a similar point in their life did this, so, I mean, he's just this incredible filmmaking prodigy, almost. I mean, he did this, and then he did La La Land. And First Man wasn't, like, you know, total, you know, dog shit or anything like that. It just wasn't as good as the first two. So, but we'll see with Babylon. That's going to be a big one for him. I think people are going to be like, okay, like, can he do what he does without the music? Because Whiplash, obviously, you know, music's a big focus of it. La La Land is a musical. And then First Man was, you know, some cookie cutter Neil Armstrong biopic. All right, moving on. All right, during the more intense practice scenes, the director wouldn't yell cut so that Miles Teller would keep drumming until he exhausted himself. That's one of the things that I think, you know, was really cool, I think, about Miles Teller's performances in this movie is, like, he does a lot of the drumming himself. Not all, but a lot of it. And, like, you just see, like, he's got such a great arc in this movie. Like, he starts off as, like, very, like, bashful, like, you know, 19-year-old kid who doesn't really know any better. And, like, he just drives himself insane during this movie. It's really the only time I've ever, like, seen Miles Teller in a movie and just be like, that was fucking awesome. I know he hasn't really landed as much as I think people thought he was going to. He felt like he was going to be, like, the next big thing for a while. Like, I know he had this, you know, he does War Dogs, he does... the Divergent, I think. Whatever the Shailene Woodley movies are, you know, he was in those movies. He does a Fantastic Four thing. So, like, he seemed like he was, like, being set up to really take off, and it just never happened, I guess. He's not done by any means. He's leading he's the lead in the new Top Gun movie, which keeps getting delayed. So we'll see what happens after that, but... Yeah, I don't know. Just one of those bizarre things where it's like he was just set up so well for success and it just never happened. Or hasn't happened, I should say. He's still a pretty young guy. All right. Moving on to our third and final Did You Know. Okay. In the scene where J.K. Simmons yells, "I will fuck you like a pig," you may notice the camera cuts away from him as he delivers that line. That line was actually taken from the short film. The original line was, "I'm going to gut you like a fucking pig." Damien Chazelle thought the new line was hilarious and included it in the production script. Simmons thought it was ridiculous and refused to say that line, but Chazelle included the mistake in post-production anyway. Interesting. So, I mean, hey, it's. I mean, you have the same actor playing the same character and you're shooting it the same way. Why not, you know? It's just more footage to use, I guess. All right. So that is Whiplash. I'm going to give this one 5 hazmats. I don't throw that number out there a lot, but I give... Oh, hell yeah. Fuck yeah. Coda just won Best Ensemble at the SAG Awards, so fuck yeah. That's awesome. All right, big night for Coda. And Squid Game. I don't think anyone saw that coming. Squid Game won, you know, all the TV awards it was up for, and Coda's doing very well. I can't. The TV's muted, and they're you know, giving their acceptance speeches in sign language. So I'm not really 100% sure what they're saying, but this looks awesome. That looks, that's really, really cool. Good for Coda. Anyway, Whiplash. Yeah, I give it 5 hazmats. I don't throw a 5 out there a lot, but Whiplash is just that damn good. You know, not everyone will probably love this movie. And I think it's a movie that, you know, as much as I love it, it's not really meant to be consumed like over and over and over again. Like, I think this is probably like the 4th time I've seen it at length, I think, 4th or 5th, so, but yeah, it's absolutely fucking incredible. You know, you're going to be thinking about it for a while the first time you see it. J.K. Simmons, like I said, gives just the performance of the decade, you know, one of, in my opinion, so. Whiplash, it's on Hulu right now, so you can go check that out. Highly, highly, highly recommend this film. All right, let's talk about some of the other stuff going on. SAG Awards I will get to later. Like I said, Coda's still up there giving their acceptance speeches, which is fucking awesome. That was awesome. That was my favorite movie from last year. All right, but let's talk about some of the other movies I watched. And I watched a bunch of them this past week. Most notably, a lot of the Oscar stuff is, you know, becoming more readily available. So let's start with The Eyes of Tammy Faye. They started on... well, it's playing on HBO Max right now. This movie was a little divisive to me because I thought Jessica Chastain was fucking incredible in it. Well, completely well deserved the Oscar nomination that she got for it. And the what's interesting about it is like the makeup, the hairstyling and makeup teams also got. Nominations for this movie as well, and it's so interesting because like I remember seeing stills from the movie and the trailer, and I was like, she looks like shit, like why would she get nominated for this? But then like once you like start to realize the context of the story, it's like, oh, like she's like that's like on purpose, like they made her look awful on purpose. So yeah, I mean, Eyes of Tammy Faye was, you know, it was something. She's really, really good, but she's really, really annoying, her character is. Andrew Garfield's, you know, another strong performance as well. He had a great year between this and Tick, Tick, Boom and Spider-Man. You know, just, the man was all over the place this year, and he showed off a lot of great range. He was very, very, very talented actor. His makeup did not look as great, I will say, in this movie, and, well, not as great. Not as well done, I should say. the story moves really fast, you know, in my opinion. It's, you know, it's your classic, you know, origin story, you know, rags to riches kind of thing. And then once you get to the top, the only way to go is down. It basically tells the story of Tammy Faye and Jim Baker, who were one of, you know, these like pioneer, like televangelists, who were kind of some of the first people to really take televangelism and like make it an empire, so to speak. So whether it was like they got their own channel, they had this whole network and stuff like that. So it talks about the rise of that. And, you know, it's an interesting story, I guess. It's, you'll see a lot of parallels between this and The Righteous Gemstones. Which is the season finale, I think, is actually airing right now as I speak. But that's an incredible show you absolutely should be watching, especially if you're a Danny McBride fan. That's on HBO. But yeah, so you see a lot of similarities to there. The movie as a whole doesn't really, and I like this, and Righteous Gemstones does it too. It's not really making, like, pointing out flaws in, like, religion and, like, making fun of, like, you know, their beliefs. In any way, you know, of course, you know, they're televangelists, like, it, you know, it is a big part of the subject matter, but it's not really poking fun at that. And like, because so many times in Hollywood, you just see people being like, oh, like, you know, they're Christian, they believe in God, like they, you know, are these crazy people, and like, why would you do that, and this and then science and yada 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 yada. This doesn't really do that. It pokes more fun at the kind of like hypocrisy of, you know, these televangelists and guys who become these like multi-millionaire kind of like, you know, scuzzbags, you know, kind of just, you know, what's the word I'm looking for here? Scavenging off like the, you know, these poor people who, you know, they get them in with like faith and stuff like that. And it's like, Jesus wants you to give you he wants you to donate. He wants you to pledge. He wants you to do like this, 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 and this. And then they use it for personal gain. So that's kind of more what they're talking about this movie. And you know, it's a little all over the place as far as genres go. You know, I mentioned it's a very standard biopic. There's comedic elements in there, but it's also very, you know, heavy at points. So Eyes of Tammy Faye, it's on HBO right now. Not my favorite movie of the year, but, you know, by any means. But Jessica Chastain alone is worth it to me. I think it's a really, really good performance. And apparently SAG agrees. Like, I guess she won, and I thought Nicole Kidman was going to be the frontrunner for Best Actress, but I think that just changed tonight. So we will monitor that one closely moving forward. All right, moving on. Next up, The Mitchells vs. the Machines. Brenna was out of town for a couple days this week, and I spent the time watching cartoons for children by myself in the apartment. Mitchells vs. the Machines. I'm not enough people talked about how awesome that movie is. Either that or I was just very late to the party on this one. So I know it came out like, I think it was like the summer of last year or something like that. Very, very funny movie. Kind of gave me some Lego Movie vibes. I know Phil Lord and Christopher Miller were associated with this one. I think they were just producers as opposed to writer directors like they were on the Lego Movie. But, you know, movies a triumph in creativity, really. You know, it's about a family, you know, facing a robot apocalypse, and, you know, they have to save the world from that. But in the family, you know, the main character, she's this girl who's getting ready to go to film school. So, you know, you see her, and, you know, she goes off about how, you know, she sees the world cinematically, and movies are really the only thing she's ever understood, and she's weird, and people don't really get her because she just makes these movies. She has this awesome relationship with her little brother, who's obsessed with dinosaurs. They have this, you know, very funny dog. Danny McBride voices the dad, who's this kind of like Mr. Fix-It, you know, kind of dad who's, you know, very dad like. And then Maya Rudolph plays the mom, who's just trying to keep everything together. But she's very funny in her own right. So it's a very, very silly movie. Great for really people of all ages. It's very, you know, it's a really simple plot. You know, it's extremely predictable. And, you know, there's so many things like you'll see in the movie, but, and you're just like, all right, well, that's how it's going to get solved at the end. Or it's like, okay, like this is going to get called back to later on, and you'll bat 1,000 on those guesses. But that's totally fine. Like, it's not like it's a kid's movie. but sometimes like all you need to make movies like this, as impactful as they are, they just need to be funny. And that's what this movie did that in spades. I was belly laughing for a lot of this movie. That was Mitchells vs. the Machines. It's on Netflix right now. Highly, highly, highly recommend it. It's up for Best Animated Picture this year. I don't think it'll win. I think Flea will. But you're not going to see me kicking and screaming about it. But yeah, Mitchells vs. the Machines on Netflix. Go check it out. Very, very funny movie. Especially if you have kids. You know, watch it with them. They'll get a kick out of it. All right, moving on. The Lost Daughter on Netflix. Another Oscar-nominated movie this year. Maggie Gyllenhaal is up for Best Screenplay. Olivia Colman is up for Best Actress. And what's her name? Jessie Buckley is up for Best Supporting Actress. I did not like this movie very much. I think Olivia Colman was great, as always. And I thought Jessie Buckley was good, but nothing really stuck out as like, oh, like, give her an Oscar, you know, she, like, she's nominated for, like, I, you know, I see her get nominated, and I see some of the people who got passed over instead of her, you know, like Katrina Balfe. And by the way, I've been calling her Catriona Balfe this whole time, and watching the SAG Awards, I realized that it's Katrina. I'm just like, I'm a fucking idiot. Because she spells it like C-A-I-T-R-O-N-A or R-I-O-N-A. And I'm just like, Catriona, that makes sense. But then, like, they said it on the broadcast. I'm just like, it's fucking Katrina. I'm a goddamn idiot. but yeah, like, how, like, you know, Katrina Balfe or, like, Jodie Comer in The Last Duel, like, how people like that get looked, you know, overlooked for something like this. I was like, eh, what are we doing here? Yeah, I mean, the movie as a whole, it's not, you know, it's not a fun watch. I think the first act is very intriguing, and it kind of sets you up as like, okay, it's going to be this, like, psychological kind of thing. Basically, you know, this woman, played by Olivia Colman, she goes on this vacation by herself to this island in Greece, and she meets this American family while she's there. Dakota Johnson is the mother in this family, and her daughter's her daughter goes missing. Dakota Johnson's daughter goes missing. Olivia Colman finds her, and then brings her back to Dakota Johnson, but the girl's doll goes missing as well, and this girl's like freaking out about the doll going missing, and like it's this running thing throughout the movie. She's like, the girl can't calm down because she lost her doll, and you know, Olivia Colman sees you know, just how worn down Dakota Johnson's character is, you know, just by like how exhausting the, you know, her daughter is. And this movie's great birth control. Like, the kids are so fucking annoying in this movie. So that leads us to a series of flashbacks, which involve Jesse Buckley's character as young Olivia Colman reflecting on her relationship with her kids. And then I don't want to go into it too much with spoiling things, but like, it's basically, I'll say this, it starts off really well. You know, it sets up an intriguing, potentially intriguing storyline. The middle of this movie is awful. It kills so much momentum. They spend so much time on storylines that, you know, you just don't, it's a, what is it, show don't tell kind of thing. That's the thing. Like, it's more effective to show the story than to just like spell it out. This is a 2-hour movie. This movie could be an hour and a half easy. You could easily lop off 30 minutes, and it's pretty much all Jesse Buckley's stuff where you, that you can cut out of this movie, and I think it would have been way, way, way more effective. Yeah, it's just movies, and the ending is not satisfying at all. You know, I don't. Again, if you're interested in it and you want to see it, I'm not going to spoil it for you. But starts off really strong, completely loses you in the middle, and then the ending just is. There's no payoff to any of what you just watched. So. I was hoping, I know this one got a lot more love than I think it deserves. The screenplay in particular, I think, you know, when it got nominated for an Oscar, I was like, okay, great, like, you know, I'll check it out. No, it was, this movie stunk. So, Lost Daughter, it's on Netflix right now. Olivia Colman, you know, well-deserved praise for her. I think, actually... And speaking of Olivia Colman, because when I looked at the SAG Awards when CODA won, they kept cutting to Olivia Colman for some reason, and that's because, was she a producer on this movie? Writer? No? Thanks. Why did they keep cutting to... Oh, well, whatever. All right, anyway. Oh, Olivia Colman's in Mitchell's vs. the Machines, too. So we're going to... I think we talked about two different... Yeah, we talked about two different Olivia Colman movies back-to-back. Look at that. But yeah, she deserves her Oscar nomination. She's very good. And you know, it's just a great performance for... And otherwise, kind of... If... Without her, this movie gets no recognition whatsoever. But Olivia Colman's, like, the... you know, she's one of those performers right now where it's like, if they're in it, it will get nominated for stuff. So that's that. The Lost Daughter, don't recommend it. All right, moving on. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the new version, the reboot, so to speak, is on Netflix right now. Came out last week, I believe. And you never would have guessed it, but it's not that good. No way. You know, I watched it. I love a good slasher movie. You know, when I was a teenager, I was very, very, very into horror movies. And slasher movies were, I mean, a slasher movie has to be one of two things. It needs to be either scary or it needs to be fun. Because, you know, it the way people, by the very nature of the movie, like, it's a genre designed to kill people and do so in very gory ways. And, like, if it's not scary, because, you know, I'm not the kind of guy that, you know, like, gore doesn't really freak me out that much, so it's, like, the fact that, like, people are getting, like, cut up and whatever, it's like, that doesn't make it scary to me. It's like, it's the build up and, like, and, you know, jump scares are so just fucking cheesy and cheap, and, you know, I hate people who do those. You know, look at a movie like Halloween. I mean, the old Halloween is, yeah, you might look at it now and just think, like, well, this isn't scary, but, like, it laid the blueprint for you know, slasher genres. You know, look at you know, the original Friday the 13th, or I mean, Nightmare on Elm Street. I mean, it's a dying genre. When was the last time a good slasher movie came out? I put that question out there on social media, and someone had responded to me and said, like, it was actually our frequent guest and collaborator, Casey Hsu. He reaches out and said, Tucker and Dale vs. Evil. And I was like, yes, that's what a great slasher film should be. So, because, like, that movie's definitely more of a comedy, and it's more of a parody of slasher films, but like I said, it either has to be scary or it has to be funny. And that movie is very, very funny. And it does, and, like, it plays on all the tropes that you know, we've come to expect from slasher movies. But, anywho, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the reboot, it just stinks. It starts off okay, I guess. But, you know, once Leatherface is, you know, running around doing his thing, it's really nothing special. Like, the it also feels like there's, like, a lot of, like, social issues that they tried to jam in here as well, which, you know, when you're watching a horror, you know, when you're watching a slasher movie, it's like, it's not, you know, it's not the place to do it, I guess. But but yeah, I mean, I'm glad I watched it. You know, I don't remember the last time I watched just a straight up slasher movie. It's been a minute, so you know, always a nice refresher. But damn, man, I mean, I don't know. I mean, movies as a whole have just got, like, horror movies have gotten so far from the slasher genre. I feel like right now the thing is, like, ghosts and, like, true crime, and stuff like that. So if you look at, like, the Mike Flanagan body of work, yeah, like, some of his films are brutal, but they're very, like, ghost centric. And Midnight Mass, for example, that was a lot of vampire stuff in there. So, but, you know, as opposed to just, like, a guy in a mask running around with a, you know, insert weapon here, it's kind of a dead genre, and that's a damn shame. The horror genre needs a reboot. It really does. What was it? Oh god, there's one with Vince Vaughn. We talked about it last year. Didn't come out last year. Freaky, I think it's called. It was a combination of, like, Freaky Friday meets, like, Friday the 13th or something like that. It was actually really funny, and that was decent, but it was, like, it was a very silly, like, comedy, like, not so much a horror movie. But either way, I said my piece. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it's a dud, but it's on Netflix, so if you're into that kind of thing, go check it out. All right, I have two more films I want to talk about. Next up, The French Dispatch. It's on HBO Max right now. the latest Wes Anderson movie. It stars just about every actor that's ever been in a movie. You know, just off the top of my head, you know, Jeffrey Wright, Adrian Brody, Bill Murray, Jason Schwartzman, Owen Wilson, Timothée Chalamet, Frances McDormand. Gosh, who else is in there? Elizabeth Moss. I feel like I'm leaving out one of the big storylines in the movie. I don't care. All right, so I'm a little torn on this one. So the movie is a series of vignettes, and it's told as if it's like an article, or it's like an issue of a this newspaper called the French Dispatch. So like there's a vignette with like Owen Wilson where he's talking about like the city life and places to go and things to see and stuff like that, tourist attractions. And then there's a piece about with Benicio del Toro and Adrian Brody about what's her name, Lea Seydoux, Benicio del Toro is like this, he's a prisoner, but he's also this like master, what is it? Artist. I'm drawing a blank on what kind of art it is. Adrian Brody's this dealer who, you know, meets him in prison and he wants to sell his paintings and stuff like that. So there's a whole article about that story. And that's, it's narrated by, God, who's that one from? I'm completely drawing a blank on that one. Then there's another one involving Frances McDormand and Timothée Chalamet, who's, you know, she is a writer who's involved with this boy who gets himself involved in like this revolution, so to speak. And then there's another one with Jeffrey Wright who talks about like a kidnapping and the plot to get like this French officer's son back or something along those lines. So it's an interesting series of vignettes. It's the most Wes Anderson thing Wes Anderson has ever done. Like pretty much all of his tropes are here on steroids. You know, the quirky dialogue, the wacky characters, the, you know, the costumes, the production design. Technically speaking, this was a very, very well done movie. You know, the production design and the costumes in particular were absolutely incredible. But then the problem with the film, the cinematography as well, and like some of the stuff that you know, they were able to do is just absolutely mind-blowing. But the problem with this movie is like I didn't personally care about any of the characters. You know, we spend so much time jumping around from story to story. There's too many characters. There's got to be like over 100 speaking roles in this movie, and it's only like 2 hours, less than 2 hours. And I don't know that you, like it's not like the Grand Budapest Hotel or Darjeeling Limited or the Royal Tenenbaums, where it's like you actually like, you know, it's a deep dive. Like, yes, it's an ensemble cast, but you're able to dive into some of the characters, you know, fairly well. You don't really get that with this one, which is a bummer. Like, you know, it's essentially like 4 or 5 different short films in here, which isn't a bad thing, you know, by any means. But there's no one to root for, and there's no one to root against, really. Which is, I don't know, it was frustrating to watch, because I love Wes Anderson, I really do, but this movie is not giving him any ammunition. Like, if you wanted to show someone, like, if you wanted to introduce someone to the world of Wes Anderson, do not show them this movie, because he does every, like, this was him kind of, like, throwing the kitchen sink. You know, it's almost like, something that I thought I could compare it to is David O. Russell with American Hustle, which rhymes. And so David O. Russell, like, yes, he was around for a long time before this, you know, Three Kings and I Heart Huckabees. But then he kind of had this like career resurgence around 2010, 2011 when The Fighter came out, and, you know, it was just very different. It was in a, you know, hit at the Oscars, critically and commercially successful. And then that leads into Silver Linings Playbook, which had a very similar, you know, stylistic feel to what we saw in The Fighter. And, you know, they're same thing like that. And Silver Linings Playbook was a little more successful than The Fighter was, you know, like it was a bigger commercial hit. Jennifer Lawrence won an Oscar for it. It was nominated for all this other stuff and blah, blah, blah. Then he gets to American Hustle. And it's that thing with like the third film from these guys, so to speak, where it's like the, you know, third film in a trilogy where it's like, okay, like now you have the money, you have the budget, like you have unlimited resources, go out and make the movie you want to make. And it sucks because it's too much. And American Hustle is way too much. There's just so much going on that, like, yeah, it looks great. Like, there's cool costumes, the camera work's really cool, the set designs, and, you know, they have all these big name actors in there. That's great. The hell's the movie about? Like, you know, the story's all over the place. You know, this one's a little more structured, but it's also, it's like micro structured to a point where it just becomes really, really annoying. In my opinion, there's just, yeah, there's just so many different characters. I mean, visually speaking, like, this is probably the best thing he's ever done, but from story-wise, which is what I love, you know, the first Wes Anderson thing I saw was The Royal Tenenbaums, which is one of the great ensemble cast ever, in my opinion. You know, that the family story there with, you know, that family is just absolutely incredible. And then, you know, you see that again with Darjeeling Limited and Grand Budapest Hotel and, shit. Why can't I think of this Wes Anderson movie? Oh, well. Well, we're moving on. Moving on to bigger and brighter things. But anyway, French Dispatch, I was indifferent. I didn't like it, but I also like watched it and was like, oh, this is cool. But I just, I liked everything about the movie except the story, which is the most important part of the movie. But that's on HBO Max if you want to go check it out. If you're a Wes Anderson fan, definitely do it. If you're not, and Wes Anderson is something you think you might enjoy, don't watch this one first. Watch some of his older things like I said, Royal Tenenbaums and Bottle Rocket and Rushmore, Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, Darjeeling Limited, which is my favorite, one of his films. Watch one of those. Work your way up to this. all right. And last up, this afternoon I went to the movies and I saw Uncharted, a new movie with Tom Holland and Mark Wahlberg. And this was about as basic bitch of a action adventure story as you could possibly get. It's just a ripoff Indiana Jones, if you ask me. I know it's based on a video game series, but nothing in this movie I saw was like, oh, that's new. Like, everything was just so cookie cutter, from the characters to the action sequences. And, you know, all the best action sequences, they pretty much showed you all of it in the trailer. So I didn't like it. Not that it was a bad movie or anything like that. Like, it's clearly supposed to be like a fun blockbuster kind of, you know, film, but I didn't have fun. None of the characters were particularly interesting. None of the action sequences were that, you know, above and beyond. It was just a very basic bitch action movie. It's a video game adaptation, clearly trying to get a franchise going. But Tom Holland's got to like get like he kind of just played like Spider-Man with like a shitty Boston accent in this movie, which. I mean, I like Tom Holland, and I remember seeing Devil All the Time. It was last year or the year before. He was great in that movie. It was so, so different from Peter Parker and this whole, you know, Marty McFly thing that he does. So I love to see him do more dramatic roles, you know, stuff where he's not jumping out of shit and just flying through the air the entire time. Like, I'd like to see him actually start to do more, because I like Tom Holland. I do. But, like, let's mix it up a little bit. Like, you know, like you're fucking 5'2". Like, you can only be an action star for so long. Although Tom Cruise will beg to differ, but Tom Cruise didn't start off doing action movies. Tom Cruise had this great, really cool career with all these different films, and then he became an action star once he like just figured that he's done it all. But But anywho, yeah, Tom Holland and Mark Wahlberg. I mean, it's Mark Wahlberg. It's a hit or miss. I think it was one of his misses. But it's a character we've seen him play thousands of times at this point. So, all right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. SAG Awards. I don't know who, we'll dive into that maybe a little more next week. But we're coming up on an hour here, so I'm going to wrap it up. Go follow us on social media. We're at QuarantinemaPod, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also subscribe to the show, Spotify, and iTunes. And in the meantime, don't be a hero. Stay inside and watch a movie.